My name is not Trudeau. I am actually Shira Shavi. Trudeau is sitting here in the front of the audience with me, and I'm going to just start and give some background, and then Tree is going to take over. Lori Kohler wasn't able to be here with us this evening. We're coming from San Francisco. We're from the University of California in San Francisco, and we're coming from the Correctional Medicine Consultation Network. This is a picture from San Quentin, one of the prisons in California that I'm sure most of you have heard of. So what we'd like to talk to you guys about tonight is just a little bit about the work that we're doing and kind of how we got involved in this work. And first things first, I just want to kind of give a little bit of background about kind of what's going on as far as healthcare in the prison system in this country, particularly California, and how the universities got involved. And then Tree will talk a little bit more about what we're actually doing and sort of how we're evaluating our own program. So I think it's really important just to get a sense of incarceration in this country. For some of you, you may know this, but I think for other people, maybe not realize the extent of incarceration in the United States. But we have 2.2 million people who are in prison and jail at this moment in the United States. And we actually have the highest rate of the highest per capita rate of incarceration in the world. So it's not something to be proud of, but we are leading the world as far as number of people behind bars. And when we talk about who is incarcerated in this country, it's also important to realize that we're talking about basically poor communities of color. That's where the majority of people who are incarcerated are coming from. So you can see on this chart, I don't know if you guys can all see in the back, but you can see the United States is definitely leading, and we're way out ahead as compared to our Western counterparts. So I have a little pointer. Oh, thank you. So here's the United Kingdom, Canada, Germany, France, all right around here, and we have the United States here. So we are far and away incarcerating way more people than our Western counterparts, and I think it's important to realize that one of the main reasons we're doing this is actually based on our drug laws. We tend to incarcerate much more around drugs. We have things like mandatory drug sentencing, three strikes law. And in the last 30 years, not only do we incarcerate more people than other countries, but our rates of incarceration have been increasing. And in California in particular, we've tripled the number of prisons in the state of California in the last 30 years. And a lot of it is due to things like the drug laws. So when we talk about California, California is also winning the race as far as having the most people in prison compared to any other state in the country. So in California right now, we have 170,000 people in our state prison system. That's predominantly male and, again, predominantly poor people of color. So a very similar demographic that you see throughout the states, although it may vary a little bit depending on if there's a predominance of Latino or black people, depending on the state that you're talking about. This is another picture of San Quentin. So when we start thinking about prisons, we have to think about the history of prisons, right? So we've known that the population has grown exponentially in the last 30 years. We have more people in prison, and we also have people in prison for much longer periods of time. So they're getting older in prison. And so it's not surprising that you're seeing more chronic disease in prison. And what's happening is when you think about healthcare in the prison system, you have to realize the prison system is punitive, that it was originally made to punish people and was not actually there to provide healthcare services. And it really wasn't until the 1970s when the Supreme Court said there's actually a constitutional mandate to provide healthcare to prisoners. So based on the Eighth Amendment, you know, the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, inmates have a right to health care while they're incarcerated. So it really wasn't until in the 70s where prisons even started thinking about providing health care to the patients that were inside prison. And so you have a system that's really meant to punish. They're trying to put in health care. And then you have a system that's exploding with the numbers of people. People are getting older. You see higher burdens of chronic disease, very high rates of mental illness, very high rates of substance abuse, and other infectious diseases like hepatitis C, HIV. So, for example, hepatitis C is a 30% prevalence in the prison system in California. And when you talk about the community, it's actually less than 2%. So it's a huge difference. Again, with HIV, very high prevalence. So we're talking about a population that has a very high burden of disease is in a system that's not meant to provide health care. So you can kind of imagine what might happen over time. You actually have patients who are having very poor outcomes in the system. And this is really demonstrated in California. In 2002, there was a class action lawsuit against the state of California, and it was called PLATA. And this lawsuit basically was showed that the state was being negligent towards prisoners and was not upholding the constitutional mandate that they needed to provide health care to the prisoners. And so to give you a sense about how bad this actually is or was at the time of the lawsuit, there was actually one inmate a week who was dying because he was not receiving adequate health care services. So in 2002, the state lost the suit and was basically recommending that they needed to change their practices and provide better health care to the inmates while they were incarcerated. So the state attempted to do that, but unfortunately the problem was so vast that they weren't really able to live up to the settlement agreement that they needed to in the time frame that was provided. And so the federal judge in charge of the case got frustrated and actually appointed a federal receiver. So now the entire system, 170,000 inmates, 33 prisons in the state of California, is under federal receivership, which means that there's a federal appointee, his name is Robert Sillin, who is in charge of all health care services for the state of California. So he's not beholden to the legislature or the governor and has a lot of power to really make change in the system. So there's a lot of momentum right now to actually change the system and improve health care services for the patients that are incarcerated. I think the other thing to think about, we've talked about burden of disease, growing number of patients behind prison, behind bars, older patients. We talked about the fact that it's a system really meant to punish. One of the things we didn't talk about is that, unfortunately, there were not very qualified providers in the system either. At the time of the Plata lawsuit, only 20% of the physicians were board certified in primary care. So the majority were not actually qualified to be providing the services to the patients in the prison. And also they did a study and found that 20% of the physicians had some prior action against their license, and 14% were actually on probation with the medical board. So the medical board of California was essentially revoking people's licenses but still allowing them to practice in the prison system. So you could see how this was contributing to the problem. So there was a lot of challenges. When you think about trying to make change in the system, there's a lot of challenges. And some of them, you know, we sort of discussed. But I think one of the key things is also to realize when you have a provider who's in prison, they're also isolated from the community the same way that the patients are. And they don't have access to the bigger community, access to specialists, to information. There's very little technology in the prisons, no internet. And it sort of, over time, led to sort of poor standards of care within the prison. What happens, we've noticed, is that as providers are in the system for a long period of time, they actually start to take on the role of the custody officer or the guard. And this is sort of highlighted by, there was one case that I reviewed where a provider was frustrated with his patient who was diabetic, who wasn't having well-controlled sugars, and so he asked the guards to search the patient's cell for candy. Because he was frustrated that he thought his patient was eating candy. So you can see that he's sort of taking on the mentality of searching the patient's cell, which is obviously very inappropriate. And you can imagine over time that this would also lead to very poor relationships between the patients and the providers and a lot of mistrust in the system. So these are some of the issues that we're trying to deal with when we come in to try and improve the healthcare. I think one of the other key things is just realizing there was no model even of primary care. So the basics of when you see a patient, you make an appointment to see them back in a few months, that didn't even exist. And the only way patients were seen was by them writing a note and asking to be seen. And there was really no system of follow-up. So just even instituting the basics like primary care is a major hurdle that needed to be tackled in improving care in the system. This is another picture of one of the prisons. So just briefly, who are we? We're from the University of California in San Francisco. We're physicians, nurse practitioners, and nurses that are basically specialists in primary care. And we're coming in as consultants into the prison to sort of help address some of these issues and try and improve health care in the California state prison system. Just a quick outline, you can see we have different arms. We really try and focus on the most vulnerable populations within the prison, so patients who have serious chronic disease, who could get sick pretty easily, pretty quickly. So we have a primary care arm, HIV arm, chronic pain, and we do have some specialty care. And Tree's going to talk to you primarily about our HIV program, and sort of that really highlights a lot of the work that we've been doing. So some of the ways that we improve the patient care are things like peer education and professional development. So things, same things we do at the university, a lot of teaching, mentoring. We consult on some of the high risk, which are basically complicated patients with chronic disease. We bring in students and learners, get them excited about working in prison, and recruit new staff into the prison, and also help build bridges between the nursing staff, the mental health staff, and the custody staff. And by doing this over time, we're really hoping to shift the culture within the prison and provide higher quality care. So this is where a tree's going to take over. This is a picture from one of the prisons. You can see we have a serious problem with overcrowding. We're at 200% capacity in the entire system. So this is all the gymnasiums in the state have basically been turned into housing units, and this is one. And these are not just double bunks, but triple bunks. So this is, you can see this really contributes to the difficulties in providing care to our patients.
Thanks, Shira. Thanks for staying this late. It's past my bedtime, so if I start nodding off, just give me a shake. And you can also see then that these kinds of conditions make things like infection control and drug use and so forth a lot more challenging in the prison system. I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk now about what we're doing in our programs to improve the quality of care, both through individual level clinical care, but also through some public health efforts as well. This was basically a slide showing our evaluation efforts. We're not going to really talk in much detail about our evaluation efforts, but just so you know that there are some evaluation efforts going on, and we're looking at concrete health outcomes as well as some process measures as well. But our basic set of programs start with an assessment of what's happening in each particular prison. California has 33 prisons, and the Plata lawsuit covers 32 of them. And so we've made visits to most of the prisons and done an assessment of the quality of care that's happening, including the health outcomes of each of the inmates. And this typically starts with a high-risk chart review. So we've reviewed overall about 5,000 charts, and within the HIV program itself, we've reviewed 1,000 charts throughout the state. There are about 2,500 to 3,000 HIV-positive inmates in California, so that means that we've sampled approximately a third of the charts. We basically make visits to each of the prisons and look at problem areas. So how are the CD4 counts, the viral loads, are patients who need to be on antiretroviral medications actually receiving them or not? And we look at comorbidities. So there are a lot of diseases that HIV-positive inmates have in addition to the HIV, and we want to make sure that those are being taken care of as well. So in addition to this very labor-intensive chart review, we also are starting up a program where we're creating an electronic database where we have access to the pharmacy records and to the laboratory records of all the inmates, and can basically search through and see who's at high risk for developing an opportunistic infection by comparing their CD4 counts to the medications that they're taking, and make sure that the provider who's taking care of them is aware of a deficiency and can take care of that. This is another image from San Quentin. And based on those chart reviews and from interactions with clinicians at each site, we make we make recommendations at multiple levels. So we make recommendations about individual providers. If we see problem prescribing patterns, we may say this physician is not qualified to take care of HIV-positive inmates, and you should shift around their clinic. We also make clinic-level, policy-level, and systems-level recommendations as well. So some of these sites that we've been to don't have very basic things like follow-up of previous visits. Some of them don't routinely provide lab results to providers, and so you may have a lot of inmates with laboratory abnormalities that aren't being followed up on. So we're creating sort of a clinic flow to ensure that there's good follow-up. We also make recommendations at the laboratory level. So a lot of sites weren't ordering the right follow-up HIV testing or HIV viral load testing for inmates, and so we made recommendations about what were the appropriate tests to be ordering. And at the systems level, there's a lot of challenges in correctional health to providing good care. And it's, so it's not always an issue that the providers aren't competent. For example, if you have 12 patients docketed for your HIV clinic, and a lot of whom need follow-up immediately for their failing viral load or what have you, and then suddenly there's a lockdown because blood was found in a stairwell and they need to count everybody, then suddenly, you know, you have 12 patients who aren't being seen in a timely manner. So we make recommendations about how to improve those systems and to make sure that folks have follow-up. We also make policy-level recommendations at the state level. So Shira mentioned that we essentially report to the federal receiver, and we sit on this statewide advisory committee that makes recommendations across the state on which institutions have good HIV positive clinics where they have providers who know how to take care of the HIV positive inmates, and we're making a number of reforms as shown here on improving the system statewide. So what else do? We provide hands-on clinical care, and this means for about 1,000 patients in the state, we're essentially seeing them either through on-site. So I myself have been flying down from San Francisco to Ontario, which is about 400 miles away, once a week to see patients. Essentially, they lost their HIV physician there, and so we've been filling in on a sort of rescue basis for many of the prisons. We also have a telemedicine setup, so this is a fairly new cutting-edge technology where we're able to follow up with patients through a television monitor rather than in person after we've had an in-person visit where we've gotten to lay hands on them and examine them and so forth. If they're stable, then they don't necessarily need to be seen in person at every visit. We also have various public health and disease-focused activities. So in Vacaville, where there's the largest number of HIV-positive inmates, approximately 700, we have been doing education with the providers and with the inmates. We're about to start a video project, actually, where we encourage people to come into testing through video monitors that are placed throughout the prison. In addition to the HIV program, we have a number of other public health programs as well. This is at the California Institute for Women, which is one of the women's health facilities where there are a number of HIV-positive inmates as well. So in addition to those hands-on activities, we're also doing educational and training activities with the providers at the prisons. We've been holding HIV provider meetings. Part of the cultural shift that Shira alluded to is that we are trying to bring in an atmosphere of academic interest in the patient's care. So we're holding journal clubs and really helping the providers see that what they're doing is an honorable profession, and taking care of inmates is an honorable thing as well. And part of that means, you know, staying on top of the literature and providing really good care. I think I'm out of time, so this is the last slide. Essentially, other types of activities we do besides the hands-on clinical care include patient advocacy as well. So we've been working with inmates themselves, asking them about the quality of the care that they're getting, what they perceive to be inadequacies in the care, and then trying to turn some of those into recommendations and programs. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on transitional case management. A lot of folks that are leaving prison are basically given $30 and a 30-day supply of medications and, you know, good luck and hope you don't come back. But a lot of them end up coming back because they're not given providers on the outside, housing and so forth. So this is one of the programs that was in place before. It wasn't great. Shira has actually been spearheading a project to revamp the whole system and ensure that folks get good care both inside as well as outside the prison. Because what a lot of folks don't realize is that, you know, inmates are also people from communities. They have families on the outside. They have, and they bring diseases both into the prison but out back into the community when they leave as well. So this transition process is critical to community health as well. So we just wanted to thank the prison law office for the photos and the receivership. What's that? Okay, and if anybody is interested in working in the prison system, there's a huge amount of money and need and positions, so we're actively hiring folks who have public health and clinical backgrounds as well, and you can contact us at this info here. Thank you very much.